Welcome to the Recruiter Startup Podcast. We're heading towards the end of February here, and the news from the government is that we're going to be opening up in the coming months. Thank God. I'm sure if you're listening to this from the UK, you are well ready to get back to normal. Tomorrow is the first day of our mastermind course, so that is really exciting. I'm coaching 8 startups over a 6-month period, and really can't wait to get into it. And it just breaks up my week wonderfully. I'm one of these people who have like 30 ideas a minute. So to be able to help other people through this, it's a good avenue for my team to be able to deal with me. Our leadership network that we have with Andy Hallett is going great. And that was just one of the best decisions that we made. I've had so much learning this year. We set up Scale International, an IT sales recruitment business as well. And we found ourselves doing more and more in the HR tech space. So I thought I'd jump in and help the guys understand that world a little bit more. And I'm set up to do a series of podcasts. It's going to be its own podcast. HR Tech for Good is the podcast. The first guest is Bill Berman. If you've been to a conference, you'll have come across Bill. He is one of the foremost thought leaders in the space. He's an advisor to RecTech companies. He sits in between the product, the money, and the TA. And he's got some real strong views on the future of work and the future of recruitment. So really enjoyed it. I've got a load of other podcasts in the bank already. So hope you guys enjoy this. You'll find all future episodes under its own banner. I'll be doing a bit more promotion about it. If you're in the HR tech world, RecTech world, and you think your product solves something and it's going to be a force for good, I would love to have you on. So that's all for today. I hope business is going all right for you all, and everybody's optimistic, and it seems like everybody's starting to hire again. I know it's been a tough time for a lot of us, but it is all to look forward to. Have a great day. All right. Welcome to the first ever HR Tech for Good podcast. I'm joined by my co-host, long-term friend, Jonathan Fisher. How are you, sir?
I'm fantastic. Thank you very much. I'm looking forward to having some interesting conversations about tech for good going forward. And we'll see what new stuff is coming on the market and ideas what people have. It's going to be interesting for me.
Right. So who would you want to kick off this podcast with? I asked myself that question, and I had to bring back to a talk that I went to. I was traveling around the world and living out of the back of a car with the wife. She wasn't happy about that. I was living the dream. She wanted to come back to the UK, have babies, get the business serious, all that jazz. So I found myself in London at a recruitment conference. Do you know who came on the stage?
No, tell me. Who came on the stage?
Bill Berman came on the stage. And
the legend himself.
The legend himself.
Long beards.
And he did a talk on how the algorithms were going to get you. And everybody in there, most of them were agency. They were like, who is this guy? What is he on about? And the other guy who was... I think he was the chairman of the REC, the Recruitment Employment Confederation. He was like, don't be listening to Bill, you know, like it's okay. Just stick to the phone. It's fine. And I remember being absolutely just mesmerized by, he had this vision of what was coming around the corner, and I could logically see it, but I didn't have access to the stuff that we have access now to, you know? Mm. So first guest, Bill Berman. What can I say about him? So he's best known for his True events. So he runs them around the UK, where they're the Unconference conference. So before it was like conferences were like, people were just slinging stuff at you, trying to make you buy stuff all the time. They're a bit formal. He changed the game on that. And he had like these pop-up conferences where people went and added value and had real conversations in the HR, recruitment, technology environment. So really interesting. And I think he's done that for about 10 years. And he recently decided that that wasn't what he was going to do. And I've been following this guy on Facebook for a while. I think I might be a bit of a fanboy, actually. But I was watching all the good work he was doing with the homeless. Or the rough sleepers, as he calls them, in his hometown of Northampton. And in this interview, you know, we dive into some of the work that he was doing on that. But what I really wanted, why him as a first guest? And I think the answer to that question is he sits in lots of different camps. So if somebody's, if a PE company is going to spend their money, they're going to speak to him on where they're going to spend it. If somebody's developing their product, he's going to be like, well, what are you solving? And who are you solving it for? And what's it fixing? Like, and then with the HR internal recruitment community, it's a lot about, you know, where are they going with things? What biases are people trying to get rid of? What ethical questions are there? And because he sits in all this world and has an idea of what's coming next, the conversation was all over the place.
I imagine so. I mean, he sounds like some kind of a seer, kind of prophet kind of guy who's looking towards the future and answering questions and scaring us to death at the same time.
Yeah. Well, also, he is a stand-up comedian. So we had some laughs. It was a great episode. Really enjoyed it. And we will go over the episode now. And afterwards, we'll have a bit of a chat about the stuff that was discussed. All right.
Looking forward to it.
All right. Welcome to the first ever HR Tech for Good podcast. I'm joined here by the good man, Bill Berman. How are you today, sir?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. How are you? Nice background.
Yeah, I know. I have a few. I have a few others I could change it to.
No, that's good. London in my eye. I haven't seen London for nearly a year.
I had one of Joe Exotic as well. I've been following you a little bit on Facebook. Wanted to say, commend you, first of all, for the work you're doing with Rough Sleepers. It's kind of inspired me a little bit. I think, like, how can somebody, maybe give us a bit of an insight in what you're up to and how people can get involved and help out?
Yeah, so it's been a whole kind of full thing. I don't like using the word journey. That sounds very X Factor, but it's kind of been like that. So first lockdown, I'd been working with a charity weekends and stuff doing dinner for rough sleepers on the market, breakfast and stuff. And then when the lockdown came along, they needed someone to do the breakfast. So I started cooking and delivering breakfast, and all of the soup kitchens closed down because you couldn't social gather. And I started going out to where people were. And I did that for 122 days. So I did dinners delivered. Then I went to a central location when the central places started opening up again in the first lockdown. And I've been involved a lot more in working closely towards transitioning people into housing and working with mental health, opening bank accounts, doing all kinds of stuff and really understanding the problem. I think what we've had, I mean, the shorthand version of it is I've always been very passionate about getting involved in something. Last year, we hit 10 years of True London, and I was going through this phase of I actually wanted to stop being angry Facebook guy and go and do something, but trying to find something which was directly benefiting people rather than talking about benefiting people. And I think what COVID has given us is time, right? I would never have had this time in a lifetime. I wouldn't have been able to spend...
You're normally traveling everywhere.
Yeah, I'm normally traveling and now I'm not. So I would never have had 14 months to do this. And I certainly wasn't expecting it to be on my doorstep, like literally, you know. So everything's come together in the right place at the right time.
Good for you. Big problem in America, this at the moment. I was out in LA
I was doing some podcasts actually with some of the recruitment owners out there, and like I was tripping over homeless people on the streets. And then I was going into like plush offices where people are doing really well. The polarity between the poor and the.
I compare it to, you know, when I was the most kind of striking memory I have in my mind of poverty and wealth as a comparison was when I was in India. And you kind of expect that kind of experience in India. You don't expect that in London or Dublin or wherever you might be, right?
Yeah.
And I remember that I was in a Google building. And a Google building is a Google building. You can order any kind of food. You can have anything you want. And this is as Bangalore is developing out. And next to it was a plot of land that had about 300 people living in shanty houses with nothing, right?
Wow.
So right from that point, that was kind of one of those striking things of you've got this disparity of people who have and people who haven't. I think in poor countries around the world, people who've always had nothing are better geared. They don't know what they don't have, so they're better geared at living that life. And I think in kind of, if you want to call it developed world, whatever you want to call it, you know, you don't expect that in London, you don't expect that in Dublin, but the numbers have been going up every year. The benefit is certainly in the UK, the numbers are changing. We've been able to get about 130 people into housing. We get into the end of cracking the rough sleeper problem, I believe.
Pretty cool.
There's been two benefits. One is everyone in from COVID has meant there's been a big focus on attention on who these people are. The other one is we have a government, and it isn't a moral question, it's one of optics. People on the street is very bad optics. So they've made money available, right, for dealing with that problem. They haven't made money available for dealing with lots of other problems, society problems that we have that cause it around issues like mental health and addiction and availability of housing and so on. But we've got optics on dealing with the problem. So it's been a really unique time in that we've been able to focus and work with people. COVID's been very good for homeless people because we've been able to get them inside and get them sorted.
Wow. No, it's really good. Fair play.
But it's time, right? For me personally, I would have probably spent a lifetime on committees, being a trustee, raising some money, doing whatever. This way I've been able to get in and get sorted.
So normally you're a very busy guy, travelling everywhere. I'm not going to try and describe what you do because I think I was just briefly saying it before. You're kind of pulling strings on a few different levels within the HR tech arena. How do you sum it up?
How do I sum it up? So I work directly with startups on what they need at their stage of growth. So primarily it's around talent acquisition rather than HR in general, but market position and so on. I also work with VC companies on where they should be investing, what might be interesting. And I'm increasingly working with PE companies where more products are getting rolled together into a platform approach. So that's been a lot of my work in the last 18 months. I sit on the board of Vonk on behalf of a PE firm called Capital D, been involved in some acquisitions. It's figuring out what does core technology need to do in the talent space. Then I also work with companies like NASPERS, BBC and so on what technology they should be using. And then I just have this big community. True is at the heart of that, but I have this big community of people where I'm constantly in the conversation around candidate experience or whatever it is.
Well, that didn't happen overnight, Bill. You didn't know. PE companies weren't knocking on your door 10 years ago, were they?
No. No, that's really been the last 18 months.
How did it come about?
I think it's really, one is you have to be around long enough. You see a lot of instant brands, right? People who will be famous for 5 minutes and then they'll disappear. And I'm not saying I'm famous, but
I get you. Yeah.
I'm famous in my space. I'm the world's tallest dwarf, right? You know, I work in the small market, which the number of people who managed to have the range of experience that I have is quite limited. So one is, and also I've always spoken at conferences, webinars, you know, there's quite a lot of content in reference to me, I'm a good focal point on what's going on. And I'm normally, I think because of true in some of the work I do, I'm normally thinking a few years ahead of what the market does.
Yeah. And to give you an example of that, I came back from backpacking around the world with my wife and had to get my business a bit more serious. Yeah. And all of a sudden I find myself in a conference full of people who didn't know anything about what they were listening to.
Yeah.
And we're looking shocked. And the topic, I'm going to say it wrong, but it was the robots are going to get you.
Yeah.
Is that
the
right?
Algorithm's going to get you. That's the one.
The algorithm's going to get you. And it almost took Kevin Green a moment to be like, don't listen to Bill. It's going to be okay, everybody. You're all right. And then they sat down and they're like, what is this data thing? This is only like 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah. What's data? What is it, right?
Yeah.
Which is
did the robots come and get us? Did the algorithm kill us?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the big thing that's happened with COVID is we've kind of jumped 5 years in digital transformation. So a lot of the things that crazy guys like me were talking about as being good ideas, like working from home or being remote, or everyone jumping on Zoom calls every 15 minutes to communicate, or chatbots, all that kind of stuff, were a forced reality. By COVID, right? So digital transformation is ahead, and that creates a new world where basically everything that we do is digital, therefore everything creates a footprint, therefore everything creates data.
So I have a HR product. I come to you. What questions are you asking me straight off the bat?
Well, so there's four things I'm interested in when I look at any technology. I do a lot of demos. I see a lot of things. The first one is there a real need for this? And the answer to that is quite often no. What's the problem we're trying to fix here?
Yeah.
Because invariably, if you've got an HR product, it's a point solution. What's the problem you're trying to solve, and is it really a problem? And is it a problem that people would actually pay money, big enough problem for you to want to pay revenue? So that's the first one. Yeah. The second one then is scale. How much of this is really what we see a lot of, which is people hidden behind technology? So how much of it is actually... Yeah. some secret sauce or algorithm, whatever you want to call it, you know, how much is...
AI platform are going to solve this, and there's like 50 people...
Yeah, I'll blow that one out and say I still haven't seen any AI in the recruiting or HR space yet.
Okay. And because there's a difference between AI and automation?
The difference between AI and automation, what we are seeing, and this is what we should be celebrating, and this is the bit that we should be getting right, particularly when we're talking about technology for good, is we're seeing magnificent machine learning.
Okay.
We're very good. There's lots of data, and we're very good at processing data and recognizing pattern on scale because we have technology that enables us to do that. It's what we do with those conclusions to make sure we're working in the right way. So.
Okay. What does tech for good mean for you?
Well, it's exactly that. It comes back to the same principle. Does it make things better? Right? Does it make things better for everybody? Because it tends to be technology tends to favor one stakeholder or another. So if I give you some examples of that, we're doing some quite advanced stuff now in matching technology in ranking candidates and sorting out candidates and that kind of stuff. And you've seen some very clever tools for doing that, as well as some of the ones that I'm involved in. The way in which organizations were gauging whether a matching technology worked was taking, say, 100 jobs and taking 1,000 candidates, giving them to their crack team of recruiters, their recruiters, and saying, right, you sort them into a short list and then put it in the machine, and saying, does the machine shortlist look like the people shortlist? And if those two things look the same, the technology was a good investment because it was coming up with the same conclusions. Downside of that is the only thing that does is mean you can get rid of all the people.
Yeah. And the people could be wrong.
Right. And it doesn't make anything better. The other thing you do is you take all the biases and all the things that we're becoming increasingly aware of, and you put them on steroids because you're doing it with a machine that can process it a million, can be unbiased, can be biased a million times more than you can as a human. Because as a human, you can only look at a certain number of CVs in a day and make a biased decision over those, right?
Yeah.
As soon as we learn that biased decision and learn that behavior and create that as a rule, then we start to really get into complicated territory. There's a great book anyone who is like me is interested in this stuff. The book's been around for a good while now, but I always use it as my Bible. That's written by a lady called Kathy O'Neill in New York. Kathy, I know very well. It's called Weapons of Math Destruction. And it's the potential for damage that algorithms could cause and are causing in things. And 25% of it is written about HR and recruiting and how we machine learn the bad practices of humans and then multiply them and speed them up and do them more and get wider velocity, right? So
what are the best people doing who are using machine learning to solve problems?
Right. So really what we're doing is machine learning is a creation of rules, whatever you're using it for, right? So whether you're using it for conversational, what you might call conversational AI, whether you're using it for a chatbot, I've worked with chatbot companies, it's learning what are the rules. So when we make a decision, I had a very interesting conversation around a panel about 5 years ago, one of the Unleash events, and it was data scientists versus recruiters.
Okay.
So it was a very interesting, quite a popular concept. We had a lot of fun with it. But I remember one of the data scientists who was the data scientist for HireVue, and the argument was generally recruiters were saying, you know, almost it's gut feel, it's this natural human interaction.
I just know.
You know, I remember when we went from paper to computers years ago when I took people through that process, and they'd say, oh, the CV talks to me.
Yeah,
like the CV whisperer as a recruiter. I look at the CVs and one of them says, yeah, I'm the right person. So, and what the data scientists were saying, yeah, gut feel is really human algorithms, right? So for the last 5-7 years, I've spent studying human algorithms and looking at what they are, which is patterns of decision-making, which are consistent. And they're generally driven by data inputs into our brain, which are around things like your experience, your opinions, your knowledge,
your prejudices,
the history, right? You know, this hiring manager prefers people from this university versus that. You're collecting all this knowledge that you then consider as gut feel. That's why you know, the most common reason for rejecting a candidate is generally given as not being a culture fit or not being a fit.
Yeah.
Which is fine until you try and define what that means. Now, once you start tracking that with machine, you find consistency in those patterns of decisions that generally they're all based on the same things, the same inputs. And you can then use a machine to start to learn that, but you can then start challenging them. So you can then say, right, okay, if we always make this decision in this way, does that decision actually have any bearing on job performance? And you can begin to use other data. So once you make your gut feel visible in a model, it says, here's the rules. Here's 20 rules for ranking candidate A over candidate B. These are the decision-making trees. And when we machine learn, we look at it in two ways. So the first thing we look at is for absolute lateral rules that we can create, which are yes, no, pass, fail.
Yeah.
Right? Stop me if I'm sounding crazy with any of this stuff.
And then we
look at what we consider to be opinions.
Yeah.
Which are, these are the absolutes. This is yes, no, pass, fail.
Okay.
Got this, haven't got that, whatever it is. That's what we use for a natural ranking. That's usually our 5-second CV review. When you get CV in front of you, you go, no, not that one. And we tend to be very good at opting people out rather than opting people in. We tend to be very good at going, no, yes, no, maybe, yes, no, right? And we can generally verbalize the reasons that we say no, but not the reasons that we say yes. So we take that and then and you can put that into a model. And then when you create those rules, because those rules become visible, you can start looking at them and going, is that actually correct? You know, does that have a relevance to job performance?
Yeah.
So you can start challenging. And when I was talking about matching technology, actually, I want a machine to give me completely different results to a human, but relevant results and consistent results. So the same rules, this is especially important when we get into areas like diversity, equity, and inclusion, that we're consistently applying the same judgment to every single candidate. So first of all, we're gauging that the candidate, the judgment decisions are relevant. They do have a relationship to job performance. There is a reason why they're in there, and most of our jobs have requirements in there because they've always been there, not because anyone's ever thought, does that actually make any difference?
Yeah.
If someone goes to this university or that university or whatever it is, does it make any difference? And we can start to spot our, start to remove bias in those in that decision making.
And what type of biases normally come up?
Well, there's massive bias. I mean, you know, the biggest one that still shocks me is the judgment calls that are made on people's names, right? So, and yours would be a really good example. So somebody would look at the spelling of your name on a CV and they go, is he Jamaican? Is he like, where's this guy from?
I don't like those Irish people with fiendian names.
Yeah, fiendian names or whatever it is, right? So you might then start looking at it and say, I don't really know. So it's a massive one, particularly for, you know, there's been a lot of controlled experiments run on that, including I've run a number of them where you might send out someone's CV and put two different names on it and apply the same job. And surprise, surprise, the one with the Asian Indian sounding name is 90% less likely to be successful in progressing because people
have for this, sure. So if there's any of it, because our large part of our audience would be staffing in the staffing world, they're probably thinking, how long before their clients are going to make it mandatory that their search is non-bias and that technology is almost forced upon them?
Well, I think you've got a whole different challenge in the staffing industry, which is if, and they are, machines are better at sourcing, machines are better at matching, machines are better at matching people into roles, and that's a two-way thing. So, you know, again, when we talked about making things better for every stakeholder, it's as much about presenting the right jobs back to the candidate as it is finding the right candidates for the jobs. The same based on what we've been able to, the machine's been able to learn about you, here's the right opportunity for you, and so on. If the machine can do the middle bit, as we've seen with a lot of other industries, how long before it comes a question of what the value is in a staffing company, right? So, and I genuinely believe there's a massive value in a staffing company. The value isn't in the heavy lifting. It isn't in the tasks.
It's in the persuasion.
I don't even think it's in persuasion, right? You shouldn't have to persuade someone to take a job. That's a nonsense.
You should persuade someone to be aware of a job.
Persuade people to do anything.
No, but like, so if somebody is in a job and they're not looking and the headhunter hits them and says, hey, I know we had a conversation 6 months ago. I'm keeping you up to date.
I don't even think there's magic in that anymore. Right? Really? And I'll tell you why I think that. I think because people are, first of all, this idea of passive and active is a nonsense.
Right.
Everybody's passive.
Everybody's active or everybody?
Everyone's passive. Everyone's kind of not looking but looking.
Yeah.
Some circumstance means you're looking more desperately because you've just been laid off or you really have your boss or whatever. You know, there are people around. That's why still vast majority of jobs to fill are filled either directly or indirectly by our agencies via job posts, right? We remember when job boards were going to die and all that kind of stuff not that long ago, right? Still, most people get their job by applying for a job somewhere. At their point of being active.
So to keep you on this track.
Yeah, so what I think people are, this is where I think people are.
Yeah.
And people are very different to companies in terms of thinking. People are usually 5 years ahead of companies.
Okay.
Right? So for a whole load of reasons, people are agile, companies aren't. Companies, if you want to change your thinking, you need 7 layers of permission, finishing with Voldemort, right? You have to go for everyone. But whereas I think candidates, if you wake up in the morning and decide, oh, I don't want to do Facebook today, I want to do Snapchat, or I want to get somewhere, you can just do that. You know, you can make that decision. You don't need permission. So people are a lot more agile. What I think people are at is people are more focused on careers than ever before. They're just not focused on careers with a company. They're not thinking, right, I'm going to go work with a company and I'm going to work for them for 20 years and it's going to be really great and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
They're also not really focused on careers. They're focused on jobs. How is this job going to enhance my employability, make me more employable in the future? And they're thinking about it through the lens of a job, which is why it's not employer brand, it's job brand that's important. How is this job?
Well, before I jump into that, because we're at the risk of going into too many subjects. We're 5 years, 10 years. What does the future of the internal recruitment team look like? What is the future of the staffing industry?
Yeah, what is it? So I think the staffing industry is already massively evolving.
Yeah.
They're just doing it in stealth. The biggest investors in recruiting HR technology are staffing firms or RPOs, right? The biggest growth area of sources of hire is RPO. The biggest place where people are buying a technology is through RPO. And RPO is by default an in-house staffing company, really. They're owned by, you know, the major firms are owned by the major staffing companies. It's the same players. It's your Adecco, it's your Randstad and so on.
So I hadn't really thought about that. So the staffing world is really controlling the purse strings that does the HR
in both technology
self-cannibalizing the staffing world.
Yeah. And you know, staffing companies, if you follow these things, which I do, because I have nothing better to do at night.
That's why we have you on the show.
Staffing companies have not bought staffing firms for about 7 years on any kind of scale. There might have been a little bit of localized or a client reason or whatever, but generally, staffing firms have not bought staffing firms in the way that they did when Adecco was created. Randstad was created, it was acquisitions of major staffing firms in different parts of the world, right? And bringing them together in a body. That hasn't happened for 7 or 8 years. The investment of those companies has been in technology. And it hasn't necessarily been as, and that's been from two angles. One is proprietary technology. How do we stop this technology going into the market and use it to make our service better or more advantageous? And I think they've always had an eye on the, you know, if you're Randstad or you're Adecco or whatever, you don't want to be the next Blockbusters.
Yeah.
No. You don't want to be the next company that becomes irrelevant because, and if you think about it, the staffing business is one of the only middleman industries left, which is, you know, you sit in the middle when you connect buyers and sellers, you connect job seekers with jobs, right? If you look in travel, hotels, insurance, whatever you look at, there used to be insurance brokers in the high street selling insurance. Now they don't. It's online. You go and compare the market and do whatever you do, right? Other brands are available. So for staffing companies, if the easier it becomes through technology and network for job seekers to connect with jobs and jobs to connect with job seekers, the less need there is for somebody in the middle.
Mm.
So the value changes, right? The value of what you can offer changes to say the value isn't in the heavy lifting. It isn't in the task because we'll just automate all of that out of sight, right? You know, whether it's appointment making, scheduling, conversation, negotiation, whatever it is, we'll just schedule all of that. Assessment, tests, we'll just find a tool or an app to do that and we'll plug it in one place. So the investment in all that kind of stuff has come from staffing companies.
Mm. But all this makes logical sense. But yet the staffing world is still growing.
Yeah. So it's what it is. But what is it, right? Does it become a giant payroll center because everything goes, you know, and is it more about controlling that piece? Is it more about, Randstad made that first move when they bought Monster. And everyone kind of said, what's going on there? They bought the data. So the winners are going to be, where does the data live? If you're a staffing firm, if you're Randstad or Adecco or whatever, what do you have? You have years and years of data very focused on jobs and people. Every job you've ever taken is on a database somewhere. That's indexable. That's searchable. We can begin to...
And is that all data worth anything?
Yeah. And so what I'm seeing is more and more... breaking down of services. So you might just do the interviews, or you might just do the sourcing piece, or you deliver candidates, or you might employer brand. Most of that is being driven by RPO firms these days. You know, the RPO firms don't make any money out of the staffing contracts anymore. The RPO firms make money out of selling technology, selling employer brand, doing these kind of things, right? Really? So, yeah. So the nature of where the value is, where's the value to the customer, and where's the margin, where's the money to be made, that shifts. The margin for the staffing piece, the placement of people in the job, that's been shrinking year on year on year, right? To becoming almost a battle about price between different companies. So where the value is in the market and where the value is to the candidate and where the but what happens with the candidate is, say, actually, now I've got this career portfolio, I'm more interested in having a manager like an actor would, who's going to identify and find me the next gigs and figure out where I should be and be part coach, part manager, part negotiator for me.
So Paul's on the line now then. 5 years from now.
Yeah.
Let's go through the three of them. So the staffing world, the RPO world,
how many staffing companies are closing offices in high streets?
Well, offices is an unfair...
I'm using that as an example. So if we thought about what a staffing company was...
Yeah.
And we went back 10 years, that was the fact that you could walk down any high street and there would be an Adecco, a Brook Street, a whoever it was, right? There'd be... mold that they were like the Starbucks of the day,
yeah.
The Starbucks at the Costa on every corner, right? There was a as well as some local players, there was recruitment agencies on the high street. Now they're not, now they're in the sky, right? So it's a constantly evolving.
But what do you see it evolved to? So I'm a graduate, I come out of school in 5 years' time. I go to join Michael Page. Is it going to be like Michael Page always was, or is it going to be something?
Michael Page doesn't look like Michael Page anymore. You know, if you look into Michael Page, which is owned by Adecco or whatever, you know, there's 100 different parts to Michael Page, which are very specialist and very different and do very different jobs. Right? Mm. You know, there's very niche pieces. That's the nature of the business. So I don't think it will. These portfolio careers of what we do in the staffing industry is going to be completely different. And the key is, right, so this is the major thing. The value of a recruitment business used to be in the data it held, and that data used to be private.
Yeah.
It was private, right? You know, it was what was locked behind key. And if you want to go to the old-fashioned headhunter, it was who was in your black book and then, you know, if you knew the people, nobody else did, and you could unlock the key, and you knew the employers and nobody else had access, so you could sit in the middle and say, right, you know, I'll introduce you, how fellow, well met, and all that kind of stuff. We look at it now, that's very connecting and having conversations with people, that's a very easy digital thing to happen. So the value isn't in the data, the value is in how you interpret it and what you do with it.
Okay.
And so recruitment businesses are nothing but data businesses.
Yeah.
The way in which we interpret and use that data around recruitment is what we're constantly changing to provide value.
Yeah. And when you talk about RPO as a recruitment business as well.
Well, absolutely. Well, it is a recruitment business.
And with that, you see them as just a data business as well, but also with an employer branding element?
Yeah, but employer branding is just data anyway, right? It really, ultimately, everything is a data business, right? It's how do you collect data? How do you collect?
Where do people come into it in the future?
Well, there'll always be people in it, but the point is where you use people, I think you have to do two things. And I've looked a lot of this, obviously with Volk, I work a lot in the advertising space, so we're thinking about, right, okay, and we've introduced SaaS technology and moved a lot of our process and a lot of our customers now, enabling them to buy directly rather than indirectly through a platform and take smaller pieces of margin. So when do the people come into that? People will become a premium. So advice and knowledge and opinion becomes a premium.
Interesting.
And people will pay for that, right? They'll pay for the anyone can have the data.
Yeah.
Who's interpreting it?
Yeah. Okay.
Right? And the more that we use technology to do things like collect and interpret data and produce reports,
yeah,
the less the more we lose that underlying thinking behind it. So if I give you a really simple example, right, from the recruiting world, as a recruiter, at some point in time, you will have learned Boolean search and all this kind of stuff, right? You don't need that anymore, right? Because either Google will do it for you, or you'll have a tool that you'll go to and say, I want to find one of these, and it'll come back and it'll create the search string and it'll go and do that for you. You don't need that. You can't adjust that search unless you have the underlying knowledge of how it was created. So the value is going to be in understanding trends, understanding what data actually means rather than blindly following data. So you can begin to challenge things to say, no, we need to do something different.
Yeah.
And then we get the other bit, which is going to be the moral pieces of challenging decisions which machines are making, to say, okay, is there a moral justification in – there's a logical justification because the data says you do X, but is there a moral – what's the
who decides if it's moral or not?
Right. You know, and ultimately, that has to be a decision, right? That has to be a decision that people make. And that's either going to be a business, it's going to be an individual where you choose whether you want to engage with that or not. There's a moral question. Because we can do something doesn't mean we should.
Every time you speak, I get terrified. I'll be going downstairs now wondering about my different businesses. what's going to be around in 5 years? What am I going to say?
People will add value. Right. So I'm from Northamptonshire. I'll tell you about the shoe business, right? For a long period of time, all the handcrafted shoes factories went out of business because they were expensive. If somebody makes a pair of shoes and it takes hours and days and weeks, right, it's an expensive to go for you to go and buy that pair of shoes, pair of brogues, lopes, churches, all these kind of people are very local to me. So I've seen that business completely die. And now I've seen that business at the point where they're desperately trying to bring in apprentices to relearn the skills because people have gone, I'll pay a premium for handmade. I'll pay a premium for the person. A machine can make that, and maybe a machine can even make it better and quicker and faster, but I will pay a premium for the person. So when it comes down to recruiting, I think that's where we're going to go. You know, whether it's the candidate or the client, we will pay a premium to bring in
an expert,
to bring in interpretation, to bring in the knowledge, right? And machines will always have to learn from people. They'll have to track people. Therefore, we'll always need people. It's just what those people do.
That, for me, that's really interesting. But and it's grand because, like,
how many offices have an administrator or a secretary these days?
Yeah. So I
they used to. So yeah. Jobs will disappear and jobs will evolve.
Yeah. And what does that mean for somebody starting their career? Like, it's okay to have influence and expertise and thoughts.
Anymore, you'll start a job and you'll start a life, right?
Yeah.
And this idea of work life and these things being separated, they're not. And that's going to change.
Mine's not separated.
You know, there's work and there's life work. You know, that's the way it is. So what I mean by that is, you know, we'll look at everything as a series of jobs. So we won't look at career and say, this is where I'm going. I'm an example of that, you know, where you're saying, well, how you got involved in this? How you got involved in that? The answer is I never really had a strategy, but I react very well to situations that come along.
Yeah.
All the available information to say, this is the best path to go on. And I don't let myself get pigeonholed. I think that's what people are doing with jobs. They're interested in job. How is this job going to enhance my employability? Am I going to learn new skills? Is it going to build my reputation? Is that company going to look good on my CV? But they're really interested in the job, not the company. And so when it comes to career, we will have an evolving career. You might be a gig worker, you might be a temp worker, you might be contract, you might be full-time, you might be any number of things. You might have your own company doing stuff and be self-employed, right? You have any number of ways which your portfolio career is going to go. But I think you're going to be interested in jobs, not careers.
Yeah, I think I am. And I've had the opportunity to do it, and now I'm like addicted to doing new things. And my wife's like, not another new thing, please. Like, just,
you know, it's just taking the challenge and you deal with it and you learn about stuff and you learn to dismiss things quickly or move on or, will take that idea forward, right? So I think that's what people are going to do.
Yeah.
So and I think we've actually COVID has moved us 5 years ahead of that because people, so I'm an example where I, in normal lifetime, I spent probably 7 months traveling at conferences, speaking at conferences. My business is actually doing a bit better without me doing that. Turns out I don't have to do it, but I've done it.
Yeah,
I have done. Now, I think I will always go out and want to.
Do you miss the crack of it, though?
Meet with people and go do events. I don't think that will change. I'll still want to do those things, but I'm actually thinking I'm going to travel a lot less, but when I go somewhere, I might stay for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I can work anywhere, but, you know, I go to Melbourne, as an example, in Australia twice a year. I go to Sydney twice a year. I go to India, right, all the rest of it, in normal lifetime. I never go for more than 3 days.
Oh.
And it takes me 24 hours to get there. So I'm now looking at it and saying, actually, I don't need to travel in the way that I did. My business sustained. This bit of fear of, oh, if I stop doing that, everyone will forget me.
Yeah, you're pretty prolific with speaking engagements, aren't you?
Turns out that's not true. People will still remember me if I don't speak for 14 months, right?
Before we go, tell me some people that inspire you in the HR tech world.
In the HR tech world, who really inspires me? So Jerome Turnercheck, I think what he's doing with smart recruiters, and I'm inspired not by products or anything else or the fact that he's built four tech companies, but I think he has a genuine overriding desire for things to be better for candidates and people like that. So Jerome is a massive inspiration. Jerry Crispin is a big inspiration. I'm very inspired by people like Sam at Real Links, who I work with, Adam at Candidate ID, who are trying to do new stuff maybe quite early in their career, but they're very passionate about wanting to go and fix solutions. So in the HR tech space, there's a lot of people who, if I'm looking at an analyst, someone like Madeline Adano, I love what she's talking about, George LaRocque, what he's talking about, where he's going with stuff. So there's a lot of people that I think it's more inspirational pieces of work than necessarily people, right? You know, it's things that people do. Yeah. I'm also massively inspired by things that aren't in recruiting, but are in marketing. You know, that's what I'm looking, what's happening in marketing, what's going on, because that's what's coming down the line to us. So, but definitely, you know, I'd pick out the likes of Jerome as leading the way on stuff. I think Luke Dudler at Job Powers comes up.
And final question, what's the biggest problem that people are trying to solve in HR tech right now?
Not to buy any shit, really. I mean, generally, it's figuring out, is this myth or is this...
And if you need any help with that, Bill Vorman... Yeah,
you know, don't buy any shit, really. I think the biggest problem people are trying to deal with, right? So right now, there's always a topic at the moment.
Mm.
So I think because of Black Lives Matter and loads of things that have happened over the last 12 months, DE&I is a topic for everyone. We're actually starting to say, actually, this diversity thing, we're really not very good at this. Inclusion, we're not very good at this. I think we're beginning to learn. We've learned a lot more, I think, for everyone, myself included. We've had to look at ourselves and look at what we don't know rather than what we do know.
Mm.
Some of us might have considered ourselves experts. I think we're challenging a lot. A, what is diversity? Where do you go? Is it neurodiversity? Is it autism? Is it LGBT? Is it black, white? Is it male, female?
Yeah.
Is it people who went to university and people who didn't? Is it class-based, you know, based in the UK and that kind of thing? What is it when we're talking diversity? Is it just diversity of thought? Increasingly, I tell you, the biggest challenge I think businesses face right now is diversity of political thought right now. If you're in the US or you're in the UK, Europe, with Brexit stuff, diversity of political thought of if you're in the US, could Republicans and Democrats work in the same office, work in the same place?
I've seen you wind up people on the Facebook.
Right, but however it is, could those people work in the same place?
Yeah.
And be really good at recruiting. But so, you know, I think a whole society of views, because of the way algorithms deliver content and the way we build bubbles, we could do a whole different show on that. I think people have got more and more polarized and more fixed off. This is my view and I have no room for any other view.
Well, thanks so much for today. This was an unbelievable chat. When will you be on stage again? When can people come see you?
Well, you can go to Innovation Circus on the 25th of Feb. I'm appearing on camera. I actually went out on a real in a studio and did some stuff. But you better see me hopefully soon. My stand-up comedy career has taken an 18-month hiatus, so I'll be back. And I'll tell you, never mind stages, never mind conferences. I just want to be back in a pub again. And I just want to talk. I actually want to go somewhere where I just talk shit and no purpose.
Oh, wouldn't that be great, hey?
You know, I think that's the stuff that I would say we took most for granted, and that's the things that I miss the most.
Thanks very much, Bill.
Cheers.
I think I'm still a bit shell-shocked from that interview. I'm kind of blown away by it. There was a lot to go. And when you interview somebody who's as multifaceted as he is, I feel like once you let the genie out of the box, the conversation could go anywhere. I've tried to decipher down what we talked about. What key points do you think that struck you from what you heard, John?
Well, first of all, he's an incredibly interesting individual. It'd be someone you'd want to go to the pub and have a pint with. You'd learn an awful lot, probably about more things than HR tech. He's, I think, some of the most interesting points he hit on for me was how we were going to look at the data that we're using in HR tech that's being compiled and then having a premium recruiter analyze that data and understand where it's coming from and how it's put together. That was one bit which I thought was really interesting, probably needs a little bit more unpacking for me.
Yeah, so he also said that recruitment companies were just data companies and the skill was in the analysis of the data. Now, he also said that the persuasion element of the recruiter isn't valuable anymore. I don't believe that. I take umbrage with that. I think if you're in that job and you're doing that on a daily basis, there's definitely an element of persuasion, whether you're internal or external.
I think so. I think the thing is with this though, where he was concerned, he did say that he was really quite passionate about marketing as well. So maybe the persuasion element for him is going to be focused more on the marketing aspects, where he feels that that's where we may be taken away from.
Well, speaking of the marketing marketing bit, he mentioned that the RPO side were basically like marketing companies with bolt-on recruitment, and I never seen it like that. So, and he said if you look at their books, the money is coming from the marketing, and not the actual recruitment. And the bit that blew me away from the whole thing was, I said, well, what's going to happen to the future of recruitment agencies then? And he said, well, it's happened. And I was like, what do you mean? He said, well, they own the private equity companies who are investing in the HR tech companies that are self-cannibalizing the recruitment industry. And he was like, they're not going anywhere. They're just going to change. And I suppose the bit that we couldn't really refine is, what does that future recruiter look like?
Yeah, the premium recruiter, again, is something that he talked about. I did find that really interesting, just trying to work out how we go into unpack the data that we're talking about and have someone have the capacity to remove the bias that is put in that data, because it's all gathered from human beings who are essentially flawed anyway. So, you know, there's quite a cyclical 360 problem to resolve here. I'm not quite sure you do.
So he also spoke about machine learning versus AI, and that's a thing that comes up a lot. He believes that AI is a branding thing, and then there's loads of people and machine learning behind it's like a Wizard of Oz curtain, if you like. And I thought that was fascinating. He jumped into machine learning. Some of that went above my head. Did you catch what that meant in terms of the technology out there?
If it's the bit that I'm thinking of, the bit that I took away from it was the machine learning aspect was fundamentally going to be flawed and biased based on the information that was being input in the first place.
I think I'm still lost. He talked a lot about bias, right? And I hadn't really thought about it. Like he was saying that, like the whole diversity issue, it could be diversity of location, could be diversity of like
name,
things that I hadn't really thought about. But then it kind of brought me back to when I started in recruitment. I have to admit, we screened out a lot of names, and because when I was recruiting in Australia, they'd be like, they wanted somebody who looked just like them. They wanted somebody who went to the same school. And when you're on the agency side, you've the percentage is all about winning. You know, you have to you have to get the thing that's going to win the fee, that's going to do it. Now, if technology is going to take away the bias, how long before that's pushed on the agency side? And then they have to really do a qualitative search selection based on data and learning. That's what's really interesting. And that probably brings us on to our next guest, who is maybe not our next guest. I've got a couple of big shots coming on very soon, but we have a CEO of a fantastic company coming on soon. What's his name, John?
Depends which one we're talking about here.
Markelos.
Oh, we're talking about the legend himself. Markelos Dionos, I believe it's pronounced.
I wasn't going to try and pronounce it.
He's the CEO founder of a company called Brick, I'll give you the little strap line. They're a platform empowering recruiters and hiring managers to make better, faster, and bias-free hiring decisions through objective data and assessments.
Right. So I'm testing this product at the moment. What this means, I can't speak from the internal recruitment perspective. I'd be interested in what they have to say, but from a consultant selling into a business, for me, it's brilliant because you create the job spec with your client. And like, it's not like you're like over a phone with them doing that. You're saying like, okay, they need to have X amount of leadership qualities. They need to have X amount of communication skills. Their numerical skills are this important. And you build what that criteria is. And then if you think of the old world of Myers-Briggs or whatever, it then takes that spec and uses it to test your candidates. And then it takes away all the biases because the results are all based on the results that it gets from the test. And then you know, okay, here it is. We have the best candidate. We know it because the data said this. The data said it because it was based on what you said. And we have a fair outcome.
And the amazing thing about this as well, which I really like, is we have the ability to put the job profile in for us to find out the traits that are going to suit best for this role. We have an assessment which takes into account, I think it's 16 dimensions of personality and 4 cognitive skills. And from there, it will draw the data in, give you an overall score, and then it will provide you with questions to ask the candidate to further understand how they may fit the role that you're looking for or may not.
So I'm not a details guy. What that does is that takes away me being lazy. So if I know all I have to do is like make you do that, you'll do that. Then we make the person who's applying do it. They'll do it. And then the machine tells us what to do next. But what it is doing is it's taking away the recruiter's magic, their gut. And
is it though? I think that the thing what it's doing here is it's asking you to put the information in, utilize that information. It may point you in a certain direction, but I think towards the end of it, it's still saying it's down to the recruiter. We've got questions for you to ask to hone in. And then it comes down to where you think they fit. But it's certainly taken a lot of the time-consuming aspect of this search away.
Well, look, everybody, thanks very much for listening to this podcast. As you can see, myself and John are not the eminent thought leaders in this space, but it is our job to ask the right questions to get and to get the best guests on. And we have the best lineup of guests coming on. And I promise you, by the end of it, we'll know our stuff.